Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show. Today's guest is Ian Mortimer, the lead DevOps engineer at Slalom Consultancy.
Right. Well, for starters, Kubernetes is based on a technology that came out of Google called Borg. And it was basically, a container management system that, I think it was originally written in Go and has a tremendous amount of community support. So when it first came out, it had a lot of open source support, obviously from Google. It's written in Go, and you can really kind of see how much the community has evolved. You've got people that, like Kelsey Hightower, who were big at all the conferences, constantly talking about how that gets interacted with, the HashiCorp is now, developing a bunch of stuff around it. AWS, obviously, with the announcement at reInvent, just came out with support for it, which, it's in its early stages on AWS, right? You get it out of the gate when you go with Google Cloud. Right now the community is so exciting because you've got guys like, the Heptio crowd, which are doing some phenomenal things around Kubernetes. So now basically with Docker supporting Kubernetes, out of the gate, you no longer have a question about whether or not you're going to use Kubernetes as an orchestration tool. That's just gone away. It's become commodity. It's become standard. It's like using Linux on AWS. You're going to do it. Even though I know that some of my brethren would probably yell at me and say, no, you can use Windows as well. But now the thing is that's really exciting is the tooling that's going on. So for example, one of the best things that has come out is Heptio's Arc, which helps you back up and recover. And these are and Sonarbuoy and and Kson, which are just ways to interact with Kubernetes. Using the APIs, providing backup and recovery. Those are the kinds of things that a lot of people that are using Kubernetes in production really, really needed. So you get into this point where you need operational excellence as opposed to innovation excellence. And that was sort of the challenge. A couple of years ago, if you were going live with Kubernetes, you were going to face some operational pain, right? You were going to have to back up and recover etcd. You were going to have to, figure out how you were going to deal with storage. Now you've kind of got a better tool set, and this is only going to get better. I mean, almost every day I see some kind of new cool tool that came out. Most of the stuff that I've used to manage a Kubernetes environment, I've learned from either on Slack or Twitter. So by participating in the right channels, by following the right people, it's amazing what you can learn. And even from a lot of, following any kind of Go site or Slack channel, it has been phenomenal. And now you've got these great frameworks around Go as a language. So loving what Mark Bates is doing around Go Buffalo. It's basically a Rails-like web framework for building applications. And within a couple of minutes, you can be up and running with a full-blown application, and then you can just deploy it right to Kubernetes. So those are the kinds of exciting things that are coming out now. But the operational side of things is still a little bit of a challenge. You know, and now you've got everybody thinking they need Kubernetes when they may or may not. That's the other interesting thing. So when I was at Yieldmo, one of the first things people said was, hey, we need to get on containers and we need an orchestration layer. And the first thing that I kind of thought of was, okay, well, Kubernetes is probably a little bit extreme for what we need. And when you think about CI/CD processes around Kubernetes versus, let's say, the other tool that I'm, you know, phenomenally a fan of is Rancher. Those guys are doing some awesome stuff. And now, when I got them into Yieldmo, you know, we just went with their own implementation of an orchestration layer. And orchestration layers, you know, in general, they basically handle the networking, deployment, management, the stopping and restarting of containers and the operational part. But Rancher had its own orchestration layer. And I thought, okay, let's just go with that, because from a CI/CD perspective, I don't have to switch YAML formats. I don't have to, you know, put another step if I don't need to. And so, but now, due to their API, you can actually take your Docker file, deploy right to Rancher, and, you know, go live on Kubernetes, which I thought was a phenomenal move by them. So that's pretty exciting as well. And their new installer is incredible. You're getting a lot of people that are coming out with, you know, different installers now. So the community is great around Kubernetes, but where companies are going to win, where they're going to get, you know, challenged to hire is around the tooling that's necessary from a DevOps perspective. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It absolutely does. And, you know, it's a difficult decision to make from a high level, as you were alluding to earlier, as when to make the decision on going in on something like a Kubernetes. You know, I think these decisions are going to be more and more prominent for technical leaders. You know, how do you manage those decisions?
So, you know, it's really funny. What I've seen is, you know, you need a daring, innovative leader, and then you also need someone who's the polar opposite, that's risk adverse. And that to me is a good winning combination when you get the balance of those two. So, for example, in large enterprises, right, they're probably already using Kubernetes in some form or another, but not in production, right? They're just not there yet. The risk mitigation and permission crowd probably won't let them go there. Startups can do it, you know, overnight because they're startups. You know, they'll embrace something, but, you know, they'll tend to move a little, you know, and the startups obviously will move a little quicker. But with enterprises, they don't, you know, really enjoy, you know, doing bleeding edge stuff because they've got so much legacy software. So the first thing you have to do is say, okay, how are we going to migrate to this kind of platform? Right. And you've got, you know, an assessment you have to do, on a technical level, a very detailed level about how cloud ready, cloud native, 12 factor, whatever you want to call it. How ready is someone to do that per application? And then you've got multiple teams. You've got multiple architects. Then you've got IPsec. Security is a big thing right now. And it's only going to get – I mean, security is only going to get more prevalent as a concern going forward. I mean, you've got the Intel issue that just came out the other day. You know, that pretty much hit like every Intel chip that's ever made or something. So, you know, you make that decision based on a combination of, do we have the people? Are we ready? What do we need to do to be ready if we're not ready? And then what's the time frame and how high a priority is this? Because ultimately, you know, one of the things that working with containers facilitates is, you know, a reduction in cost, a probability of predictable operational excellence. But it takes a while to get there. And so, you know, while it seems all great on paper and everyone imagines this land of milk and honey where, hey, we're running everything in containers and nothing ever goes down, the truth is, to get to that promised land, you go through a lot of steps. And so you have to be aware of what those steps are. So there's a huge refactoring that's very often on order. There's a lot of tooling. You have to make the decision. And this is where I was really proud of David Cohen when I was at Yieldmo. He basically said, like, look, we're not going to be able to deliver new features. We need to take a step back and improve our infrastructure. And, you know, he did a phenomenal job of managing that conversation. But really, it's about, you know, the story that you want to be able to tell. Do we want to be the type of firm that just deals with our legacy, or do we actually want to move forward and beat our competition? And someone's going to have to be daring enough to say, hey, listen, I'll own this. And you need someone like that. And, you know, then you need someone to enable that possibility.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's that mentality, and the sense I get from, you know, from DevOps and conversations that I've had with, you know, other DevOps experts, is that it's very much an attitude and an approach to doing things, you know, above all else.
Yeah. I mean, you know, with companies that are taking on a more DevOps-y culture, and by the way, if you ask six people what DevOps means to them, you're going to get seven answers. You know, it is an attitude of let's move forward, let's innovate. We don't have to, you know, live in this world of, you know, downtime for deployments and, you know, pager duty. I mean, I think honestly, I think in a lot of ways, a lot of firms are realizing that if they don't move forward, they're spending a lot of money to keep the lights on as opposed to improving the lights. And, you know, if you don't get rid of your technical debt, you're not innovating. If you're not innovating, you're not building new products, and then you're not moving forward. And then eventually someone's either going to sell you for parts, or they're going to say, well, you guys haven't built anything new. And I'm reminded of that, that scene from Steve Jobs, the movie, where Michael Fassbender is, you know, he's playing Steve Jobs, and he just goes, and you guys, you know, spent $1 billion to the tune of zero new products. You know, what were you doing? Eventually that will happen if someone does not innovate, if they don't build something new, if they don't reduce cost, if they don't, you know. So, you know, that, but it's, that's not solely with DevOps, right? Because that's where a lot of people have innovated, but the software engineers are the ones that are actually building features. The DevOps guys are just helping them get there. So, but the main thing is to reduce technical debt so that you can innovate. Right? And that's, I think that's the main attitude.
Yeah. And I think innovation is a loose term as well. So, you know, how do you kind of perceive it, you know, and how have you, you know, considered to innovate in your line of work? You know, it's not always about shiny, latest and greatest necessarily.
I kind of take the approach of, so like, I cooked when I was a kid, and I always found that I was better off by cooking with someone better than me. And I think that's true today of technology and DevOps. So when I think about innovation, I think about Kelsey Hightower, Jess Frizzell, Andrew Clay Schaefer, James Waters, like people that are very well known in the industry, and I follow what they say and what they think. Because, and I think this is sort of a lost art of admiration. And when you think, you know, when you think about chefs, right? Like the Michelin star, world line, you know, like world class chefs, they always learned from someone. They always followed someone. They develop their own techniques as well, but they get inspired by other people. And I think the inspiration part of innovation is key. So who are you inspired by? Who are you, you know, who are you watching in the industry? Who, you know, what interests you? And I find like with innovation, you can either, you can make something cheaper to run, faster to run, easier to run. And I'm reminded of this story that I've told a couple times. I used to have this this client that loved to call me at like 7 o'clock on a Friday night to ask for a build. He did, like, he literally deliberately did it on like every Friday. And I think it was just because he just, oh, it's happy hour in New York. I have to call Ian now. And so, but he would do this. But then back then, this is about 2007, 2008, I'd have to rush back to the office. And we were doing something for the iPhone at the time. So it was very early on. And I remember getting just frustrated with this guy. So, and also with my friends that were telling me like, ah, you got to go back to the office. So I worked with a couple of engineers and built a web-based way to run the build for him that I can, you know, get to from my phone and format it for the iPhone. And I thought, wow, that's to me like a good moment of innovation where I'm taking a problem and I'm attacking it. Right? Now my life is easier. I'm less stressed, which means I'm probably going to be a nicer person. So that's sort of like how I think of innovation. When I think of, you know, when I think of what makes us more comfortable in our day-to-day lives, it's stuff that's easy to use, stuff that's frustrating to use, just kind of just adds stress. And I think with a lot of DevOps, anything that's, you know, improving the ease of use, that's your point of innovation. That's your, you know, that's you making your life easier for that day.
Yeah, I agree. And I think any innovation is such a broad term, but the innovation that I'm fascinated by at the moment is, as you say, it's operation things. It's, you know, it's even behaving and how you interact with people. It's how you innovate your day to make it more effective. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I'm interested in, because I think that's the stuff when people consider innovation that they actually overlook.
Yeah, I mean, look at phone calls right now. Nobody calls each other. Everybody texts each other, because, which is kind of weird, because if you think about it, the point was to actually connect with the person. But, you know, I can't tell you how many times I see someone, they go, why are you calling me? That's so like 10 years ago. Like, and I'm like, well, just wanted to hear your voice, man, you know? But the other thing I think of is we have a more rapid sense of innovation right now, where it's almost overwhelming for a manager, because you have so many options that to choose one is almost to choose wrong, or that's the feeling that they get. So if you take a look at, you know, you got Red Hat, Ubuntu, you've got CentOS, I mean, Kubernetes, Aprenda, Rancher, CoreOS, you know, and a bunch of other open source companies. It can be overwhelming to do some kind of proof of concept. So with that many options on the, you know, it's like being at a diner. You know, you have every option on the planet. It's hard to make a decision. And so that's where a lot of what I'm finding is, a lot of companies, they can't move fast enough. They can't hire fast enough with knowledgeable people. And so their rate of change gets slowed due to a lack of skill set. So if you think about trying to hire a DevOps person in New York right now, it's almost impossible. You've got tons of demand, very little supply. But also, you know, when you get someone, you're kind of going to get the tool set that they're comfortable with. Right. So you may not get an objective opinion, or you may. I mean, you know, I have a couple of friends in the industry. They want to try something new. They're tired of working with Chef or Puppet, and they want to go with Terraform and Ansible, or they want to, you know, use CloudFormation scripts, whatever that is, you know. But the truth is, it's very difficult for managers to make an informed decision. And that's the problem when we've got all this innovation happening. It's sort of like we're hurting ourselves by moving so fast. We're all about coulda, not shoulda. And so what I do find is you get a lot of people that are going to services companies, right? They just hire out to someone and say, hey, listen, you got to train us up on this stuff, or you've got to do a mix of training us and managing this for us, because we don't know how to do it and we don't have time to ramp it up. And that's another thing I'm seeing. And, you know, I think that's a good approach to get started. That's a responsible and sort of, you know, from an operational perspective, that's a very careful approach. But you still need that person that wants to just, you know, go there and say, look, I'm going to use this new technology and I don't know how it's going to go, but I'm going to try it anyway. But very often I'm seeing a lot of services firms, you know, start to get their DevOps story together. So they create SWAT teams, they create, you know, subject matter experts in AWS, Google Cloud, Azure, etc.
Interesting. So, Ian, obviously we get around to talking about you at some point. So your background, you know, what was your kind of start and I suppose progression through your career to, you know, the point where you're
at? I probably had one of the most unconventional starts ever. I graduated from BU with a degree in magazine journalism, and nearly overnight I started working at a startup outside Boston. Because back then, if you could spell HTML, you got a job at a startup. And so, you know, bit by bit, I spent a lot of money and time on reading these giant rocks books, WROX. They were about 700 pages a piece. And I read them day and night to teach myself how to become a software engineer. And obviously I would ask questions from the guys at the company, but you know, then I moved on to Sapient, which is where I kind of really kind of learned the craft of building good software. I worked with a lot of great engineers there, but you know, over time I did various management roles. And now I'm in a role where, you know, I'm doing a lot of advisory, but I'm also doing it from a hands-on perspective. So, hey, let's go build a reference architecture for CI/CD using Kubernetes and then distribute the code. Hey, you know, I want to interact with this API. I'm going to build something in Go. And so I like the ability to have a vision, but then also have the ability to execute the vision. And that's basically me. I mean, when I started going to BU, I wanted to own a deli.
Nothing wrong with owning a deli.
Nothing wrong at all. It's just one of those things. And, you know, it's actually really funny. I told my parents that and they were obviously very thrilled. And then I had to clean a grease trap one day, and that was pretty much the end of me wanting to own a deli.
Well, I can't say I blame you, to be honest, between me and you. It's a lot cleaner using computers.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little less grease. But, you know, but it taught me the value of, you know, I don't know, taking advantage of an opportunity, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I think so. And I think for the best as well. I mean, you clearly, I think it goes without saying, in one of the more compelling industries, and even deeper than that, you know, I think DevOps is a fascinating space at the moment as well. When you look, you know, when you're looking now, you know, obviously, you know, we're at the start of 2018, so I think everyone's in that kind of perspective phase, you know, just after New Year's, thinking about what's going to happen this year. It's probably an interesting place to be where you are now to even, you know, think about, you know, how DevOps is going to evolve over the coming years, and probably something that's even hard to contemplate to a certain extent.
Yeah, it's a daunting task. You know, what I can say about that is security is going to be a huge concern. You know, we're not really getting better. We're getting worse. But we're getting better at finding out how we're worse. We are definitely going to be looking at a lot more enterprise level cloud deployments. Finally, you know, just going beyond the POC phase, you're probably going to get people that are, you know, companies that are actually going to production. you know, you're going to get a lot more with government running on your AWSs or your, you know, Google Clouds, Azure, et cetera. You're going to see an explosion, I think, in like online learning of these technologies from like Linux Academy or Udacity, Udemy, you know, because you can, for $30 you can a month, you can learn how to be a DevOps engineer, to take a couple of, you know, qualification tests, and you're a certified, you know, cloud engineer. I mean, that's the kind of world we're living in. This used to be 20 years ago, this would, you know, that wouldn't even be a thought. So yeah, you're going to see definitely an explosion of a lot of the thinking around DevOps, but even more so, you know, you're going to see a challenge around hiring in the industry, just because people can't get hired fast enough right now. You know, and but that, you know, the word crisis and opportunity, or chaos and opportunity, I think it is. It's kind of the same thing. So, you know, people have a lot of trepidation. DevOps engineers are expensive. And, you know, so they have to figure out, you know, from an enterprise level, where they want to put their money. I think right now they're putting a lot more into DevOps than they are in software engineering. But the truth is those two parties have to work together. And it's funny. I had you explain this to an analyst last night. She said, what is the, like, difference between a software engineer and a DevOps engineer? And so I was like, well, you used to have software engineer and a sysadmin. And now you got a DevOps engineer is kind of like a mix of the two. And so what that does is makes them sort of collaborate more. And that's the other thing I definitely wanted to talk about, is you're seeing a ton more collaboration than ever. And I think that's yielding brilliant things.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I think that whatever's happened, you know, you talked about 20 years ago, the way how quickly people are able to, you know, learn stuff, that's all because of whatever, for whatever reason, you know, technology's really yielded this sharing economy where people are more compelled to share their learnings. And for whatever reason, that's amazing, and I think that's really added to the innovation. I think collaboration is the main reason why now we're innovating at such a rapid rate. And with that, you know, things like educating yourself, you know, prolifically, and all everything else that comes along with that. Like, as you were saying before, you go on the Slack groups, you know, you look at Twitter. I'm hoping that this will, you know, close that gap on the, you know, the supply issue. You know, for particular technologies.
Yeah, no, I think we'll see that in this year and next year. You get, you know, if you look at the open source community of almost anything on GitHub, I mean, you could see a total explosion, right? Rancher has, you know, millions of downloads now. They started off, they had a couple thousand, you know. They've, you know, the Kubernetes community is absolutely huge, a lot of, you know, committers. So yeah, you're seeing, you know, a rise in collaboration, as a result, innovation. But, you know, on the enterprise level, now it's, hey, we just built this thing, now can we go run it? And that's the thing that's probably going to change in the next year to 2 years, is people will be finally comfortable enough to go live on, you know, in production on Kubernetes, and, you know, on a new platform, I should say.
Yeah. I agree.
Which is exciting.
I agree. I was about to say it's exciting, and it's a fascinating watch as well to see how things unfold. It's been really interesting. I think it's a good place for us to wrap up here now. We're right at 30 minutes, which is typically how long we go. But yeah, that was awesome, mate. Thank you so much for taking the time. It was great. And
thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website, venturi-group.com, and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.